at the foothills of the Appalachian chain, down through the rivers to the coastal plain. There's a place that I call home, and I'll never be alone, singing this Carolina love song. I've got South Carolina on my mind.
Here on Political Rewind on Wednesday afternoon, about 6 minutes after two, we continue with our Songs of the States as we march through the primary season. I'm not quite sure where they got South Carolina on my mind. I think that's a fairly blatant theft, but we won't even worry about that. I'm Bill Nigut. We're so glad you're here just days before the South Carolina primary, the day after Bernie Sanders came to town. Donald Trump's coming in on Sunday, so politics starting to really heat up here in Georgia. With us today, Theron Johnson. He is a Democratic strategist, campaign consultant, and has worked closely. He worked closely with the Obama campaign back in 2012, and has been an advisor off and on to Mayor Kasim Reed. We're also joined by Dr. Andra Gillespie. She's an associate professor of political science at Emory University. Todd Rehm, a Republican political consultant and the editor of GeorgiaPundit.com, which is a daily newsletter on what's happening in national, state, and local politics. And Bradley George, the Atlanta host of Morning Edition, is here with us as well. Because, Bradley, Bernie Sanders was just here last night, because you covered the event for GPB, do a little scene setter for us. How did this event all go from your point of view?
This was at Morehouse College at Forbes Arena. There were about 4,800 people there. There was a much longer line. Andra, I know you were in that line trying to get in, so a lot of folks weren't able to get into the venue. It started about an hour and a half late. It was supposed to begin at 7 p.m., but Bernie Sanders left his last event in Charleston, South Carolina, around 6 o'clock. He'd been campaigning there all day. He was hoarse. He was a little tired. The crowd, though, was still happy to see him. It was a pretty standard stump speech, and the headlines that we're seeing this morning, of course, are coming from some of the other remarks that other speakers made, particularly Killer Mike.
Yeah, and we'll talk about those in just a minute. I saw a post on social media somewhere, Andra, that this was the whitest crowd that Morehouse has probably seen in a long time, and the blackest crowd that a Bernie Sanders event has had.
I have to agree. So I think I was toward the end of the line. We did all manage to get in right around the time that Senator Sanders was starting his speech. So people were outside watching the stream on their phones so we could hear snippets of Killer Mike. But I was actually struck by the room. So when I first got in the room, the ethnographer in me was trying to scope out the crowd, and I was like, okay, so the room is probably about a third non-black. And then the more I looked, and especially by the time I left, I was like, nah, that's actually probably more like 45% non-black. And so, you know, on the one hand, that's a great show of diversity. But given what the purpose of this particular event was and the symbolism that was supposed to be inherent in the staging, I'm not quite sure that that's what the Sanders campaign was hoping for. And I was also really struck on the way out. There were campaign volunteers who were there, you know, trying to recruit people to do phone banking and other kinds of things. And yes, there were African-American volunteers who were definitely there, but the majority of the people who were asking people to sign up for phone banks were white.
Let's, Bradley, you mentioned Killer Mike, who has from early on basically endorsed Bernie Sanders. And he made very I listened today to his remarks. Is it fair to characterize them as very impassioned?
That was probably the most energetic moment of the rally. It certainly was a very passionate remarks from him.
So he apparently, I don't know where they went. I don't know if they went to Busy Bee or one of the
other. It was Busy Bee, yeah.
Well, it was Busy Bee. They went to lunch, Bernie Sanders and Killer Mike. And here's just a little bit of what Killer Mike had to say from the podium last night.
When I sat with Senator Sanders at a restaurant not far from here, bunch of people went online and, oh, he took them to a soul food restaurant. You're damn right. Because I wanted him to know that I'm not taking you here for the chicken. I didn't bring you for the collards. I wanted you to sit where Martin, Andy, Ralph, John, Hosea, I want you to sit where they sat. So before I endorse you, you understand what I expect of you. I expect for you to look out for the African-American community.
Theron, interesting timing, juxtapositioning, while Killer Mike was addressing the crowd and Bernie Sanders was here to do the same. Hillary Clinton was in Harlem, where she gave a speech on racial justice. We'll get to that in a minute. But you've been in the Clinton camp for a while now. Does somebody like Killer Mike, is this effort to reach out to African-Americans, especially young African-Americans in Atlanta, where do you think that's going to go?
First of all, I think Killer Mike deserves a lot of recognition for what he did yesterday. And listen, we got to give him credit. He is one of the most, I think, provocative, but at the same time, very influential young rappers. I'm a big fan of his. He's a personal friend, and we've debated a few times about Hillary and Bernie. You know what, Bill? I'm definitely not feeling the burn, but I definitely smell the smoke. And I think what yesterday showed us is that, listen, the Sanders campaign is doing what I've talked about on the show for a while is, okay, when you get out of Iowa and New Hampshire, how do you build up a coalition of voters that will vote for you in some of the early states? I mean, the later states. And so, you know, having someone like Killer Mike, who is a great orator, again, I'm a big fan of his and he's a friend of mine, go out and sort of articulate it into a very young, diverse crowd, I thought was exceptional. But I think the one thing I would push back on Killer Mike, and his real name is Mike Render, is to say, you know, yes, Bernie Sanders is talking about issues that are very important to not just African-American community, but a lot of different disadvantaged communities across the country. But to say, you know, really kind of make that comparison to John Lewis, who I was with today at the state capitol, and I asked him, I just think that when you really peel back the layers, Bill and others, and really look at the Sanders record and where he's been on some very key issues, I think you're going to start to see the Clinton campaign start to talk a little bit about that. But listen, to have 5,000 people at Morehouse College and to have a rally of full of young people ready to go out here, as Todd would say, you know, crawl over broken glass, I think it's a great day for the Bernie Sanders campaign, I think the Clinton campaign has got to respond.
Sorry, Andra, Bradley, either one of you want to weigh in. Did you get a chance to talk to students to hear what their thoughts were about Bernie Sanders?
I did not, because I was cloistered in the press pen. Andra, did you get a chance to talk to anybody else in the crowd?
I purposely didn't talk to students. I like to kind of just be quiet and listen to what's going on
what did
around
you hear?
Me. And so it was actually really interesting to hear the Emory students behind me trying to figure out how they could cut the line was kind of cute.
Of course the Emory students tried.
One of my students was there, and so he, you know, ran into me and said hello. I was watching sort of, you know, how people were responding. There were a couple of African-American guys who weren't sitting that far from me. And, you know, they were quiet. They didn't necessarily cheer at all the points that everybody cheered at, but they were listening intently. And then there were definitely some people in there who were true believers. And so I remembered as I was walking out, there were a group probably about three African-American people in their early 20s. And one of them was just really excited. Oh, my gosh, I just met the next president of the United States. So, I mean, I think that, you know, that crowd attracted the curious. It attracted the true believers. It attracted the people who, you know, are civically minded and wanted to be a part of history.
All right. So as long as you've got the microphone, what do you make? I asked Theron already. What do you make of the efforts that Bernie Sanders is making to attract African-American votes here in Georgia? Is it going to be a tough road for him?
Well, I mean, I think his campaign would be doomed if he didn't. And so I also think that, you know, most sentient Democrats would try to campaign in minority communities, just given the importance of the minority vote to the Democratic Party. I think at this point, now that his campaign has some legs and he might be more than a protest candidate, he's got to make a really deep-seated, concerted effort to reach out to African-American voters.
Sure.
But he's behind the eight ball in the South, where people don't know him as well. And so he's got a short period of time to introduce himself and to mobilize that group of people to actually come out and vote for him.
Todd?
I actually had an observation and a question for Theron, and that's this. There was What I'm told was about 500 people when President Clinton was in Clayton County the other day. Mm-hmm. It could have been double that, but still dwarfed by Bernie Sanders. And that seems to be a dramatic enthusiasm gap. One of the hallmarks of the Obama campaigns in 2008, 2012 was, you know, real people who aren't involved in politics having just an enormous level of enthusiasm. Is that a problem for Hillary Clinton as we go into the general election? And if it is a problem, how do you address that?
No, let me tell you why. So when we were on the 2012 campaign for Obama, I ran the entire South for him. That included North Carolina, Virginia, and Florida. Ty, we were purposely go to college campuses because it would drive the amount of people that you would want. You would always have a higher turnout because, one, is college students. They always want to sort of come out and hear the candidates. What Bill Clinton did the other day was very strategic, and I think that they intentionally wanted to keep a small crowd. So I don't think that it definitely shows that she's got more. I mean, he's got more momentum here in Georgia than Clinton. I think to Andrea's point is that he's really behind the eight ball here. I mean, let me tell you. I mean, you have not just surrogates like Mayor Reed and Congressman Lewis and others who are already stumping for her in Nevada and South Carolina, but when it turns to Georgia, which is happening now, you're going to see more and more young people. You'll see Clinton coming to Atlanta. And let's not forget, she was here about a month or so ago at Clark Atlanta University, where we had a very comparable turnout. And so I think that, again, I think the winners out of all of this, guys, are the college students who are now getting a firsthand opportunity to talk to these candidates.
That was, for me, just the hallmark of last night's rally, is that it was a young crowd. It was Atlanta University Center students. It was Georgia Tech students. It was Georgia State students. It was Emory students. But by and large, it was a very, very young audience.
Yeah, and I think Andra made a really salient point when she said she overheard a young student saying, "I just saw the next president of the United States," which is a far cry, to elaborate on what you said, Theron, from saying, "I'm going to go vote for Bernie Sanders, the next president of the United States." This was as much an opportunity to see, to some extent, a celebrity. It doesn't necessarily convert to votes, does it?
Well, I mean, I get really fangirl around politicians, not around actual celebrities. So, you know, I assumed that she was probably going to be somebody who was going to volunteer.
Oh,
Sanders.
Okay. All right.
Like, I mean, she didn't say that outright. There was a young guy and his girlfriend who were behind me in line. We walked up together, and I think the guy was from Georgia State, and it wasn't clear whether or not his girlfriend was in school. And I think she was the one who dragged him out. And so, you know, him, I'm not so sure he's going to vote in the primary. Maybe he will. He might, because he might get pressured from, you know, this person who's very close to him to be able to do so. But I think that, you know, when you're trying to base a campaign strategy on young people, you have to put in extra effort to mobilize them because their propensity to turn out is low. I mean, and probably like one more thing, especially in terms of the demographics of the group. One of the things I was struck by was, as the mass horde was walking back to the parking deck so that we could leave, I was struck by all the Morehouse students who were walking in the opposite direction from us, who had been on campus doing what college students do, going to and from class, going to the dining halls, coming back from the gym, going to the library. And so it was almost like we were incidental to the life of what was going on at Morehouse yesterday night.
Yeah, and one of the things, and Todd knows this very well, listen, I went to Clark Atlanta University. I graduated from there. I'm on the board of trustees. But they are that AUC consortium. That all those students are the biggest untapped voting resource we have in the city of Atlanta. A lot of those folks are unregistered. And so I think that the Sanders campaign missed a very, very key opportunity last night, which would have been, instead of having folks just kind of, you know, signing folks up to send the campaign, they should have had voter registration forms.
But it wouldn't have worked for the primary.
But it wouldn't work for the primary. But I'm saying that if he's going to be the nominee, I mean, I'm not saying he's going to be, but if he wants to be the nominee, I mean, that's the biggest problem that we have. And another thing about doing it on a college campus, again, these are not voters. Those college students are not the biggest block of voters that you have in any state. And so I think that the Clinton campaign and the Sanders campaign has got to get those people very active and turn them out to vote on election day.
All right. Another interesting development. Yesterday, about an hour and a half, 2 hours before the rally, State Senator Vincent Ford, who's been a guest on this show, a panelist on this show on a number of occasions, and who as recently as a week ago when I said, "What's this I'm hearing about your switching your support from Hillary to Bernie yesterday?" And he said, No. Yesterday, he did. I asked him. I called him. I said, I thought you weren't going to switch. He said, I prayed on it. Here's Vincent Ford. Because he made the switch, he actually was in the spotlight. He was given the opportunity to introduce Bernie Sanders. Let's just listen to a little of what he had to say.
A few months ago, I announced that I was supporting the other Democrat in the race. And I'm not here, listen, I'm not here to criticize her. Secretary Clinton and President Clinton have been fine public servants for our nation. But this year, we have a unique and historic opportunity to truly change America.
Bradley, Vincent Fort getting a big moment at the rally last night, and without ever questioning his sincerity, it never hurts you to swim upstream at a moment like this.
Well, that's interesting because I saw some posts on social media, folks wondering aloud if Fort's remarks, and he actually introduced Bernie Sanders. He was the last of that pre-group to speak before Bernie came out on stage, wondering if this was the first speech of Vincent Fort's campaign to be a mayor of Atlanta, because he talked about a number of issues that were important to him, where he lined up with Bernie Sanders. He went on and on, especially about pushing to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, and that was actually the biggest applause line that he got.
Yeah, listen, this was nothing but a flip-flop on behalf of the senator.
Flip-flop?
Yeah, a flip-flop. I mean, let's just call it what it is. And listen, I think to Bradley's point, look, Senator Ford has been very vocal about him wanting to run for mayor. Mayor Reed has actually come out and said, I know we'll talk about this later, that he will never be mayor of Atlanta. And so strategically, I think it was a smart move for him to try to get a part of this wave that's going on. I think long term is not going to be beneficial to him, because I think he did it because when Bernie Sanders loses and he's not the nominee, he wants to be able to try to capture some of those donors and some of those young people to help him.
Let's, as a matter of fact, speaking of Kasim Reed, Todd, last week, we know that Kasim Reed and Vincent Ford have had a long kind of challenging relationship. Andra's nodding. Todd, last week, the mayor was at the Atlanta Press Club. He was asked about a bill that Vincent Fort is involved with. It has to do with Park Atlanta. Vincent, like a lot of people, Vincent Fort thinks it's not a good deal for the people of Atlanta that the parking company isn't doing what it ought to be doing. We don't even want to get into that. But Mayor Reed, being who he is, decided to speak candidly. Let's listen to what he said.
Vincent Fort is one of the most disappointing human beings I've ever seen. Let me tell you why. No, and I feel loving. Vincent Ford's running for mayor. It's a publicity stunt. The only time Vincent Ford is on television or in the newspaper is when he does something that is opposite of me, and the guy is Wile E. Coyote. He never wins. He's Wile E. Coyote. He's Wile E. Coyote Ford.
And Todd, as Theron pointed out, he went on to say Vincent Ford will never be mayor of Atlanta. Now, that was last week. Mayor Reed is one of the biggest Hillary Clinton supporters in Georgia. And Vincent Fort breaks ranks to go support Bernie. Can you imagine the mayor's next appearance at the press club?
It's funny because it really raises Vincent Fort's stature in some ways to get attacked by Mayor Reed. One of the best things that's happened to me in Republican politics is getting blocked on Twitter by Mayor Reed.
I'm gonna see if I can work on that.
I asked Theron to work on it, but
I'm working on it. You know what? It's top of my list.
But I can say this about Vincent Ford. I talked to him about the Park Atlanta bill, and I happen to agree on that particular issue. But it doesn't require him to be running for something for him to run towards a TV camera. It's not necessarily that he's running for mayor. It's that he is ineffably pulled towards them.
Everybody wants to talk. Andre, you go first.
So, I think probably to bring this back to the Sanders endorsement, if we had to think about ideological congruence, Vincent Fort and Bernie Sanders are actually ideologically very, very similar to one another. So honestly, that makes sense. Yeah. And the dispute with Kasim Reed only highlights the fact that Vincent Fort was an unlikely surrogate for
Absolutely.
Hillary
Somewhat
Clinton.
Like President Clinton the other day at his news conference in California, deciding to say Donald Trump will never be president of the United States because he's not a serious guy. It's a very similar dynamic in that sense, really, when Kasim Reed attacks Vincent Fort, right?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I would necessarily see the connection. I mean, I think still for elite circles, whether they're Democratic or Republican, saying Donald Trump is unfit to be president is kind of the power of positive thinking. I think a lot of people are saying it over and over and over because they're really trying to counter all the poll numbers and primary results that seem to suggest that there are a lot of people who want the exact opposite of that. But I mean, I think it's actually really important to kind of point out ideologically that Vincent Fort is the type of African-American who is aligned with left progressive causes, black or white.
I just wanted to say I think it's great that Kasim Reed can think you're a disappointing person, but he'll still love you.
Well, but let's be fair here. I think the thing that wasn't, you can't, you always got to hear the entire interview, is the mayor was asked a question by someone in the audience. And we know this in politics. You never go to the legislature and introduce a bill that's dealing particularly in a mayor city and never talk to the mayor about it. I mean, that is political suicide. That's the best way to get your bill defeated or killed. And Senator Fort did that. And so I think what the mayor was basically trying to say is that this guy has been constantly opposing him on everything. And then when the mayor was asked a question, I think he just really pointed out something that was very true. And we saw this when Senator Carter ran for governor. You know, Senator Fort has never put forth anything besides predatory lending, which he gets credit on that. But that was, what, 4, 5, 6 years ago. He hasn't
more,
been able. Yeah,
more. Roy
yeah.
Barnes was governor.
Yeah, Roy Barnes was governor. So since then, what have you done? And I think what the mayor was basically saying is, how disrespectful are you as a senator who represents Atlanta to introduce a bill dealing with Park Atlanta and the Atlanta streetcar? Let's not leave that out, Todd. And never consult with my lobbyists, never consult with the staff. So I think the mayor was straight on for that. Now, did the mayor kind of go a little overboard and basically kind of say that the guy was ignorant? Maybe. But at the end of the day, if you're running for mayor of Atlanta, and I've run a mayor's race here before, guys, let's not forget that, you do not want the incumbent mayor against you. That is bad for Senator
All right, Ford. Look, yeah. This conversation all started with our looking at Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton here in Atlanta, the fight perhaps for African-American votes on college campuses. But the bigger conversation, of course, is that Clinton and Sanders are really right now both trying to reach out, Todd Rehm, to black voters and win them over. We assume that Hillary Clinton has a big head start on that. But because we've already heard so much about Sanders, I thought it would be valuable to hear just a little bit. Hillary Clinton yesterday, of course, met with African-American leaders in Harlem and then gave what her campaign billed as a major address on racial justice. So let's give her a chance. Let's listen to just a brief excerpt of what she said. And of course, she doesn't mention Bernie Sanders, but you can hear Bernie Sanders in her comments.
We Democrats have a special obligation. If we're serious about our commitment to the poor, to those who need some help, including African Americans, if we continue to ask black people to vote for us, we cannot minimize the realities of the lives they lead or take their concerns for granted. You know, you can't just show up at election time and say the right things and think that's enough. We can't start building relationships a few weeks before a vote.
So, Andra, Hillary Clinton, talking about racial justice and clearly talking about the what she sees as the belated effort of Bernie Sanders to reach out to black voters.
She's talking about that, and so I think it would be a question whether it would be a few weeks or a few months. So if we start to talk about Bernie Sanders' education on African-American issues kind of going back to, and I'm not trying to discount anything that he did during the 1960s, but in particular the gaffe at Netroots Nation, where he says all lives matter, and then all of a sudden he's developed this relationship with Black Lives Matter, to his credit. She's, you know, trying to establish that she's had a history, but she's also addressing angst amongst blacks within the Democratic Party that black voters as a base constituency regularly get ignored, that it's assumed that they're going to vote Democratic, so therefore there's no outreach that's done there. And Republicans have made that critique, and when they try to reach out to African-American voters, that's usually one of the first two or three things that they will say.
I think that's very important observation, and I had the same reaction that Hillary Clinton was being very candid, very transparent in addressing a big problem that many see with the way the Democratic Party deals with its African-American voter base.
Well, to that point, going back to the Sanders rally last night, one of the speakers who spoke before he did is Nina Turner, who's a state senator from Ohio who's been campaigning for Sanders, an African-American woman. And she was talking about this idea that, that some have put forward that the South, and particularly the African-American vote in the South, is a firewall for Hillary Clinton. And her quote, her direct quote, was, "We ain't nobody's firewall."
All right, we're going to take a break and come back and talk. Todd Rehm, you have been getting short shrift here because we're talking so much about Democrats. You've
He's
got
tweeting.
Your chance. He's tweeting.
Live tweeting.
Which I love.
I just noticed
and,
that.
And by the way, if you want to join the conversation, you can tweet us at our handle, PoliticsGPB, and we'll read some of your tweets on the air. But it's now 2:32 in the afternoon. You're listening to Political Rewind. We'll be back to talk about South Carolina and the really, really interesting Republican race going on there right now.
For nearly 3 weeks every spring, the Savannah Music Festival fills downtown venues with performances by renowned artists in jazz, classical, and American and international roots music. The 2016 festival begins on March 24th with more than 100 concerts. Details at savannahmusicfestival.org.
We're back on Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Bradley George is with us. Todd Rehm, Dr. Andra Gillespie, Theron Johnson. Todd, it's already been, you know, too many days to start playing sound again, but we saw the stage set for this final week of nasty fighting among Republican candidates last Saturday night in a debate that could only be described as one of the most intense food fights I've personally ever seen in political campaigning. Yes?
Yeah, I would agree. And you asked at the time, you know, how does this affect the Republican brand? And I said, you know, it's not. This is simmering tensions that have been there for a while. And if you've got in any electorate, if you've got 40% who is looking for something completely different than what they voted for over the years, you've got a problem. But at the same time, I think we're seeing a lot of excitement among the grassroots. And for me, at least, seeing this in Georgia, it's the first time I can remember major campaign action and excitement that the campaign's coming here, that it's not going to be a done deal by the time they get here.
Okay, so I don't even know quite how you set the stage for this. You have Trump attacking the Bush family. That's a starting point because we know George W. came in to the state the other day, presumably because the Bush family is very popular, to try to give a boost to Jeb. So why don't we just listen to a little bit, excuse me, of the sound of George W. campaigning at a big event for his brother Jeb.
Strength is not empty rhetoric. It is not bluster. It is not theatrics. Real strength, strength of purpose, comes from integrity and character. And in my experience, the strongest person usually isn't the loudest one in the room.
All right, again, no mention of Donald Trump, but clearly the reference is there. So let's listen to what Donald Trump did to try to tarnish Jeb Bush in the state by going after his brother, the former president of the United States.
We weren't safe. The World Trade Center came down, which was the greatest attack in history on this country. So you had that. You obviously had the war, which was a big mistake. I mean, I think few people would say the war in Iraq was a positive. You had him on the aircraft carrier saying all sorts of wonderful things, how the war was essentially over. Guess what? Not over. I was against the war in Iraq, by the way. I was the only one on the stage. Believe me, you should get some points for vision. But I was totally against the war in Iraq. I said it's going to destabilize the Middle East.
All right, so toss-up question. When was the last time that we saw a leading candidate for president in one given political party decide to attack that party's previous sitting president? This, Todd just talked about it, Theron. This splits the party wide open, and it hasn't hurt Trump at all, apparently. He's killing him in the polls.
You know, you got to give Donald Trump credit. I think Donald Trump has been sitting in a sort of in a building or a tree or in his plane waiting for Jeb Bush to roll out, former President Bush. And he really reminded the American people about the Iraq War. I mean, to me, that was a sort of Barack Obama 2008 moment for Donald Trump when President Obama, then U.S. Senator Obama, pounded Hillary Clinton on her vote around the Iraq War. And so, look, you got to give Donald Trump some credit. I mean, we're not, you know, going to war did not make us safer. And I think it really played to his advantage. And then the other thing I must say before you go on from me, Bill, I got to give Michael Thurman some credit because I talked to him yesterday. He did predict on this show that Governor Kasich was going to win New Hampshire. And so he wanted me to make sure that I get that in there.
Todd, does this show how raw the nerves are in the Republican Party? Can you get away with being that critical of a former president? Or, just as Theron suggests, does Donald Trump expose a truth that people have been unwilling to talk about within the party? And that is 9/11 did happen even after there were warnings from intelligence that something might be brewing while Bush was president.
I'm not sure that view of history that I think is at the very least revisionist is widespread within the Republican Party. I think there are other issues. But there are more issues related to the feeling that the elites in the party aren't listening to the everyday voters. But I want to point out that I have not seen any polls that come after the last debate in the Republican primary. There's this mythical internal poll from the Bush campaign that shows it being a tighter race.
Cruz and Trump.
Correct. But I also think that if there is a place for that level of anti-George W. Bush rhetoric in a Republican primary, it's probably not South Carolina, because I don't think that the feelings about that war are necessarily on that side, especially when you've got such a large military presence among retirees, among active duties in South Carolina. I'm not sure that is going to be one of his best moves.
Andra, so you got Trump fighting with the Bush family. You've got Cruz and Trump calling each other liars back and forth. Trump saying he's going to sue to prove that Ted Cruz is not eligible to be the president of the United States because he's a Canadian. And just a short time ago, before we went on the air, Ted Cruz in an event in South Carolina said, go ahead and sue me, Donald Trump. What is going on?
Well, I think that there's a lot that's going on here. And part of the reason why Donald Trump is attacking former President Bush is because Jeb Bush is weak. And so if Jeb Bush were a stronger candidate, he might think twice about going after him. But he figures, you know what, I'm going to give him some body blows and then I'm finally going to take him out either in South Carolina or on Super Tuesday. So, you know, at least as far as the citizenship thing with Ted Cruz, I'm sick of hearing about this. I've said on the show before that I think that this is racist. But now that if he's really going to sort of take this into litigation because nobody has actually decided what natural born citizen means, then maybe we could get the legal clarification. And the only reason I'm actually willing to throw the dice on this, and I might be thinking the same way that Ted Cruz is that from what people know about what scholars have written about this, the vast majority of people think that Ted Cruz is qualified to be president of the United States because he is a citizen by birth.
One of the things that's been fascinating to watch is that Ted Cruz has been systematically eviscerating Donald Trump by going after one thing at a time and just picking it to death and picking it to death. And it has really got it's really got Trump looking like he's frustrated, he's angry, and he's just lashing out. And if Ted Cruz does not become the nominee, and I don't think there's – I think it's far from certain that he's the strongest of the non-Trump candidates – but he could do, I think, more damage to Donald Trump through egging him on and letting Trump be Trump and sort of reveal what's under there when he gets poked with a stick. Whether that ends up helping somebody in the establishment lane or not, I don't know. But it's been fascinating to watch a master debater just take that one point and just cut him and cut him and cut him.
Well, Bradley, just before we went on the air, you had a news item that you ought to share with us now. Another a late breaking development in the South Carolina primary race, a pretty big endorsement just a few days before South Carolinians vote, which happens on Saturday.
And that would be Nikki Haley, the state's governor, who some might say could be a running mate to one of these candidates. She's endorsed Marco Rubio.
So,
I mean, one of the other things we talked about, I mean, Todd mentioned kind of the establishment lane of candidates. Eric Tannenblatt talked about that on the show last week, is like, who is it Jeb? Is it Marco Rubio? Is it John Kasich? This seems to help perhaps Marco Rubio's case that he's that candidate.
We just, by the way, speaking of the Bush folks, got a tweet from Johnny who says, cannot believe it took this long for President Bush to get back to campaigning for Jeb. So, Theron, let me ask you about Jeb Bush. Our friend Eric Tannenblatt is not with us today. The polling does not look good for Jeb Bush in South Carolina. And there has been a poll since the debate. CNN just released one, and it shows Trump way, way up in the race. Although Todd is always quick to point out that not all polling is particularly accurate. But so, Theron, if the end is near, how does Jeb Bush, can he afford, does he drop out? Because does he have to stay with it until Florida? I mean, what do you do if you're Jeb Bush and in this unenviable position where it just doesn't seem to be happening?
Well, I'm going to be nice to Jeb today because Eric is still a dear friend of mine, and I know that he listens to the show religiously. I think the rollout of President Bush was a little earlier than Jeb expected. And to me, I sense a panic in the Bush campaign saying, basically, listen, he has sort of been our secret weapon or kind of the weapon that we want to bring out later on in the primary process to try to drum up some of the religious right voters who were very, very strong with President Bush in the past. And so I think now the biggest question that Jeb Bush has got to answer is to his donors. I mean, let's give the guy credit. I mean, he's raised a significant amount of money. But how do you go back to these donors who've not only maxed out at $2,700, but they've raised you know, upwards of $30,000 and $50,000?
That's exactly what underlies my question.
Right. And so I don't think he drops out before Florida. And let me just tell you why. I think that, and I can't believe I'm about to say this, but I believe in giving credit where credit is due. I would still say don't count out the Bushes. And let me tell you why. The Bush family has built up a very strong apparatus across the U.S., particularly dealing with Republican parties. They still have a lot of people within the parties in mostly southern states, some Midwest and some western states that are still very loyal to the Bushes. I just don't know if Jeb Bush can get there. But it's something that Andrea just said. I mean, listen, Jeb Bush is just weak. His rollout of his campaign was very weak. He can't excite anyone. And so it's not really so much the Bush brand. It's the guy who's running for president at this time that's really hurting him.
And I think, you know, this could be just wrong place, wrong time.
Right.
And sadly, you know, it just didn't work out that way. And he allowed himself to get flustered by Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And it became visible and it threw him off his game. So I think he's still trying to figure out where his firm footing is, and he's going to have to figure out a way to take the body blows from Trump and to be able to kind of withstand and figure out a way to stand up that doesn't look desperate.
And Trump is just teasing. I mean, he went and got the guy's website, and basically, you know, he forgot to renew his website and went and bought the domain name.
Right.
I mean, it's just hilarious.
Part of the dynamic, though, is I think there is some sense that Marco Rubio is close to the edge and could collapse. You know, he had an uneven debate performance. He has had some disappointing results. If he comes in fourth, it puts him really in the red zone. If he's in fifth, he's in deep, deep trouble. I don't think he has built out quite as well as the Cruz campaign does. And I suspect that if you're Jeb Bush, if you're John Kasich, there is some part of you thinking, I need to stay in long enough so that if he collapses, I'm still there.
Well, and I get that, but I raised the question about Jeb Bush more than anyone else, because of course he was the great front runner from the very start, we thought. But Kasich also has a path that takes him beyond the South, whereas it's hard to see that either Jeb or Marco Rubio do if they can't do well down here. Kasich at least can turn his attention to the Midwest, right?
Yeah, but I think if you go back to what Theron mentioned, that Bush network runs deep, and I can't tell you how many people I know who have a handwritten letter or a note from President Bush or a Governor Bush or something like that, and there is an underlying ability to tap into that. People might have said, you know, not now at some point and held off, but if it comes to a point when the race is restructuring itself and the Bush network activates, they've got something that nobody else has.
I think that's a really – you've all made good points. And I probably sounded like I was writing an obituary when I shouldn't have. But I do think it'll be interesting to see whether Bush can find a way to hang on long enough keep his campaign moving forward in a positive direction. So let's do this. Let's take our final break. And when we come back, let's talk briefly about this fascinating, troubling, use whatever words you want for the what's going on in terms of President Obama and his right, his responsibility to nominate a new justice for the U.S. Supreme Court. It's 2:47 in the afternoon. This is Political Rewind.
After having written a history of American secularism and a personal history of religious conversions in three generations of her family, Susan Jacoby has written a book called Strange Gods, A Secular History of Conversion. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk about atheism, religion, and conversion in private life and in politics, and why she became an atheist. Join us.
You can hear that interview on Fresh Air this afternoon at 3 right here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Bradley, if I may, let me start with you. I thought John Kasich made a point in the debate Saturday night that's worth our starting this segment with, and that is that Justice Antonin Scalia had been deceased for less than a matter of hours before both Republicans and Democrats began pouncing on this as a political issue. Does the president in the last year of his term have the right and responsibility to nominate a new justice, or does it belong to the incoming president? And Kasich pointed out, can't we give the guy a few minutes to pay tribute to him before we start this
right,
fight?
Right, but still, I mean, here we are in the middle of an election year, and this just, it's another one of those turns. It's like a movie, right? It's just like another plot twist. It just turns it all on its head. And you know, you look at the Constitution and you look at precedent, and yes, the president absolutely has a right to name a nominee, and the Senate can have an open up or down vote on that nominee.
Yeah, I'm interested in the fact that you know, depending on whether you're the party in power or not, you can flip your opinion on this very quickly. It turns out, Theron Johnson, that 13 presidents in their last year of office have named nominees to the Supreme Court.
Bill, I think you've hacked my computer and you're like, listen, you're reading my talking points. Listen, this is ridiculous. I mean, now, I agree with Governor Kasich. Let's mourn the death of Justice Scalia. But to not allow the President of the United States of America to do what's in the Constitution, You know, Republicans like to always quote the Constitution, go to the Constitution. It's in the Constitution. You cannot come up with a plausible, rational reason why President Obama should not put forth a nominee. And it also says in the Constitution, with the consent and counsel of the Senate, to basically let the President of the United States put forth a nominee. And then, listen, if that nominee is there and the Senate decides to vote he or her down, then do so. But this is just absolutely ridiculous that Senator McConnell came out right a day after, even a day of the death when it was announced, to say, you know what, we're not going to do this during this election year.
Andra?
So, you know, I have a little anecdote about one of the people whose name has been kind of bandied about. And so these are the political appointees. So some senators have been named, and Cory Booker is one of them. And I wrote a book about him. And I remembered when I was doing my research in Newark in 2006, there was a plan by the outgoing mayor to create a board to use Port Authority money, and that he would have the authority to name people to that board. And Booker, vehemently opposed this plan because this was a way for the outgoing mayor to control a substantial portion of money. That's the kind of thing that, from a strategic and a political standpoint, it makes sense to try to oppose. But this is sort of normal business. I'm sure if Antonin Scalia could have negotiated with God to time his death, he wouldn't have died this year. Yeah. But we don't have that choice. And so when vacancies come up like this, then it becomes important for us to remember that this is just part of the job, and the timing of it is awkward, but you still kind of, the show must go on. And so the president should be allowed to do what he has to do.
Todd, it does strike me that one of the things that's interesting about this, that Georgia voters will now be hearing about this as we approach election day. This is going to be an issue in the primary campaign here.
This will be an issue for a very slim subset of voters, many of them lawyers, and some of them wannabe lawyers.
Wait. The question of whether we might have a replacement for Scalia and whether it's going to be somebody who's to the right or the left seems to me to be larger than just a matter for the legal community. No? Am I wrong?
On Sunday night, go to Donald Trump's event and see how many people can name one other member of the Supreme Court. And I don't say that just to trash, you know, just about Trump voters. Go to any event, and Supreme Court is not that, it's just not that high on the list. But one thing that I think we have to understand is that this is not a bug within American democracy. This is how it's supposed to work. The United States Senate is not an afterthought. They have an independent mandate under the Constitution to exercise their own judgment, consistent with their oath to protect the Constitution. And they are a full partner in the appointment process. And they seem to be advising that they think this is inappropriate to go forward at this time.
But, I mean, it's partisan. I mean, and so that just has to be acknowledged that this is partisan. But the last thing I wanted to point out was, and you and I were both there, when Ted Cruz was in Kennesaw, if you looked at sort of the videos that he was using in that particular rally, judges came up. So he's been talking about that, and I'm sure he's going to talk about this even more in the wake of the death of Justice Scalia.
We need to talk about where Georgia's two Republican U.S. senators stand on this, or where we don't know where they stand on this. Johnny Isakson came out over the weekend and said that he thinks the next president should pick Scalia's successor. David Perdue, who sits on the Judiciary Committee, has not said a word about this. We've contacted him about it. I'm looking at an article here from Roll Call, the Congressional Hill publication. They've contacted him as well multiple times. He's not said a word about this issue, and it's the Judiciary Committee that would have to look at any potential nominees that the president puts up.
Yeah, I want to disagree with my good friend Todd. Listen, this is a huge, and I do my Donald Trump impersonation, huge issue that not just lawyers or people who are in the legal community cares about. Every American cares about this. We're talking about the Supreme Court. We're talking about lifetime appointments, people who make decisions on marriage equality, on health care, on education, everything that matters to this country. And so, no, this is not something that can be taken lightly. And I agree totally with Andrea that this is nothing but partisanship at its best. I mean, listen, they have done everything they can to block President Obama from immigration reform. They did their best to try to block Affordable Care Act. I mean, this is nothing but another Republican stunt. And they wonder why they continue to lose elections and general elections every year for president. This is the reason why.
But, I mean, if the tables were turned, Democrats would be saying the same thing.
And they did in 2007.
Right.
Senator Perdue will be in Augusta tomorrow night from 5 to 5:15, so maybe somebody could run up to him with a microphone.
I'm sure everyone will.
But one thing about Perdue is you've also got to look at the context in which he was the guy who killed even a Senate committee hearing on a Republican who was nominated by President Obama.
Right.
Didn't even want to hear about it.
I look, this issue is going to be with us, and we'll certainly talk about it again. We're going to post on the Political Rewind website a link to a piece in the New York Times today that I thought was really fascinating. It lays out sort of the options that the White House has in terms of a nomination, not only the positive options that they may have, but also how the choices they make could, in fact, work against Republicans as a political club. So we'll put a link to it up there. I think if you're really into politics, you'll enjoy reading it. Okay, we're really short on time. Todd Ream, let me start with you. So we have the Pastor Protection Act passing unanimously in the state, not unanimously, by a wide margin in the state house. Goes to the Senate. This is the bill that supposedly the least offensive of all the religious liberty bills, the most palatable bill. And the Senate, in the Rules Committee, attaches to it Senator Greg Kirk's First Amendment Defense Act, which goes a lot further in protecting people of certain religious beliefs from having to deal with gays and lesbians. It's going to get passed by the whole Senate, but now we're going to really be in an uproar when it goes back to the House with that attachment, yes?
I said last week or the week before that the Pastor Protection Act really is a pressure relief valve for the House caucus to be able to go back after the session and say, we didn't just do the marijuana bill, some casino bills, some horse racing bills, the seven deadly sins bills. We actually did something that you can be proud of. And there are those in the Senate, I think, who would say what they did is they took the absolute least they could and put a label on it and passed it. But it also feeds into the ongoing rivalry between the two chambers.
But this whole thing could go down, even Pastor Protection. If it goes back to the House with this other measure attached to it, Bradley George, then even the Pastor Protection Act could go up in flames. Right.
Right. So I'm just curious, how are the forgive me, I've been living in Bernie land for the past 24 hours.
Are you feeling the burn?
Yeah. I don't know about
you
that.
Smell
but
the smoke.
More like that. So what kind of efforts are there to find some kind of compromise measure here?
Well, I think what was very interesting, and I got to give the majority leader, Couser, a little credit here. I think to Todd's point, they are trying to find a solution that basically doesn't have any discriminatory language in the bill, but at the same time, it's the pastor protection part of it. But I think to Bill's point, that it's going to be very difficult to get this bill passed because it's been known that once it goes back into the House. But I think that you're going to see this on the floor for a vote on Friday. I've heard from some very reliable sources today that this is going to come to a vote on Friday. So, you know, Bill, by the time you guys are having this conversation Friday, I think you'll have some more clarity on what
I appreciate your sharing that with us. And we will take it up on Friday's right. show. And it'll be interesting to see how it plays out from the Senate floor, then going back over to the House. Look, we are completely out of time on today's show. We need 2 hours. I'm going to go upstairs and talk to our vice president of radio, Tanya, and say, Tanya, we need 2 hours on Political Rewind. There's so much to discuss. She'll say no, but that's all right. Bradley George, thank you for being here. Todd Ream, Andra Gillespie, it's always great to see you. Theron Johnson, you as well. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Bill Nygut. All things considered, we'll be coming up, I guess, now in 2 hours because we're on at 2 o'clock on Wednesdays. But we'll be back on Friday afternoon for our show at 3, where we'll continue our conversations on the eve of the South Carolina primary, on the eve of the Nevada caucuses for Democrats, where Hillary Clinton is fighting tooth and nail with Bernie Sanders. So we'll see you again on Friday at 3.